42:1-4. Isaiah 42:1-4. Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nation. He will not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice in the earth, and the coastland will wait expectantly for his law.
Okay, there is a presentation handout for tonight if you want to avail yourself of that, or you can just sit back and relax and go through this with me, try to comprehend all this stuff. We're beginning the first of a series of six lessons on the case for creation. I think I've told you, I've run into this, up in Fresno, my grandson's going to Stanford, and I've been working with him, you know, about belief in God and all this, and then he comes back and goes, I'm a scientist, I don't believe in God. Well, we had that one out. But I ran into the same phrase. It's almost like they're teaching this in college. Down here, I was talking to somebody, and he goes, yeah, I'm a scientist, I don't believe in God. And with such assurance, they dismiss, you know, the concept of the supernatural or God or whatever. And two things we can say about that. One, with the same amount of confidence, God dismisses them. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. But what we're going to be looking at is the fact that, you know, we're going to pit scientist against scientist. Okay? Not all scientists, you know, ad hoc or whatever, you know, believe that there's no God. There's a lot of them that do believe. In fact, the ones that began science, pretty much science began with individuals that believe God had created the universe, and it was a cosmos, an orderly creation with laws and stuff like that. And so what they just said, you know, men like Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, Einstein, whatever, they just, you know, set out to find out what the rules were, you know, that God has set, you know, in motion. And still, there's many with, you know, as science goes on, many scientists that are, you know, convinced that there is a God, and that it's really his laws that we should be looking at. One of the other things, you know, I want to begin with is a friend of mine wrote a book called Dear Agnes, and the Agnes is short for agnostic. And he begins the book by saying, anyone who says that there is no God is a pretty much doesn't know what he's talking about, not being honest. You cannot say there is no God. Okay? In order to be able to do that, you have to look at every corner of the universe to look at it and go, okay, God's not here. And you have to do that in every corner. And you have to do that simultaneously, or as you're looking at one spot, you know, he may move, you know, before you got there. In essence, if you could definitely say, looked at every corner of the universe, that there is no God, you would be God because you're everywhere. So the most you can be, honestly, is an agnostic. Someone says, I just don't know. Because you've got no definite proof to say there is none. So what we're going to do is start off with we're going to call the model plausibility in this lesson. And just, you know, look at the two models. In fact, let me get you into it. As various authors, both evolutionists and creationists, have observed, there are two and only two possible origins to the world. I don't know of any other that's out there except something mystical from India. You know, they've got, you know, weird ideas that, you know, there's no proof for whatsoever. The other of these philosophies must be true. And the first is the concept of evolution, the model that presents the universe as being self-contained. That is, in a sense, that you're looking at something that is all there within it, you know, and that it generates itself. Okay. The other is the concept of creation, the model that presents the universe as not self-contained. And what we mean by that is, yeah, it's all there, but there's something outside of it, God, that brought it into being, is working with it, like we looked at this morning, that's holding it all together, that's making it work and doing what it's, you know, supposed to be doing. Both evolution and creation may be referred to as properly as scientific model with this disclaimer. I would say that neither one of them belong in the science lab, because you're dealing with a historical event. Okay, we know that someone like Abraham Lincoln was born, but you can't prove that with test tubes and measuring devices. It's a one-time incident, and we relegate it to the area of history. So the creation is a historical event. Evolution, if it occurred, is a historical event. There's no way of proving it. So, in that sense, neither one of them belong in the science class. On the other hand, they are philosophies that try to explain as theories to people how we all got here. Because evidently, you know, we're here. Yeah, and so that's the question. How did we get here? Where did we come from? Where are we going? You know, that's the realm of philosophy. But that philosophy or theory is what's going to be used to explain and predict the things that occur. Okay? And so what we're trying to do is, what explains what's going to occur better? Now, just at the get-go, I got to say, you know, if we're looking at something that's a cosmos and it's locked into God's laws, that's very predictable. You know, as we look at the laws, we can say what's coming up. If evolution is true, you know, we're open, you know. There are no laws, because even as we're going along, something could pop up that's different. No way to predict it or measure it. And we'll get into that. Obviously, the one that does the better job of explaining or predicting is the better scientific model, or we might say the model that better fits the available scientific data is said to be the one that has the highest degree of probability of truth. So as men have put together, you know, and discovered what are the laws of science, which one of these models adheres to those laws? In this series of lessons, we're going to be looking at the laws of cause and effect. We're going to touch on that one a little bit, you know, in this lesson, and then next lesson get in more into it. Also, biogenesis, genetics, probability, the fossil record, to show that the creation model fits the scientific data, and the model of evolution does not. But first, we will start in this lesson with the plausibility of the creation model. So what are the options? Albert Einstein once said that scientists are possessed by the sense of universal causation. I mean, that's one of the main things. If you've got an effect, you have to have a cause. Okay, that's a main given. Anything you're looking at, you know, even my hands around, you know, as an effect, there's got to be something causing it. You know, if I throw this at somebody sleeping, you know, there's an effect, but there's got to be a cause to it. What we know is, if you have something that is like a sealed container, that's a vacuum with nothing in it, nothing moves. If you do put something in it, it's just going to stay there. Okay? So, causality confirms that every material effect has an adequate antecedent cause. Don't get lost in the big words. We've just said, if you see something happening, something caused it. Yeah, we even take this into the courtrooms. The basic question then is this: can the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of new life forms, best be accounted for on the basis of non-intelligent random chance and accidental processes, or are these phenomena best accounted for on the basis of a creator capable of producing the complex, ordered, information-relating processes we see around us? Sometimes what scientists do is say, well, okay, see, things are evolving, where we would say, no, they're adapting. And the mechanism to adapt has already been designed into them by God. That's what all this means. God has given them the ability to go from one environment to another and change to protect itself in that new environment. You do that yourselves. Have you ever noticed, okay, as we move from summer here, and it's kind of extreme, from summer to winter, have you noticed the setting of your thermostat? That 70 degrees feels oh so warm in the summer and oh so cold in the winter. Because you're adapting, okay, you're changing, you know, to be able to work in the climate. Yeah, so, the universe exists, okay, therefore it must be explained in some fashion. However, there are only three ways to account for it. One is, the universe is eternal. It always has been, always will be. You find people saying this in the scriptures, 2 Peter 3, you know, everything goes on just as it always has. And Peter goes, you're overlooking something. Yeah, first of all, a flood, yeah, which messed up everything. And other things that have happened also. Second, the universe is not eternal. Rather, it created itself out of nothing. Okay. I think we're geared for this because what I've noticed on the Hallmark Channel, since July, Christmas movies have been I didn't know there were so many Christmas, you know, movies and Santa Claus and everything else, you know, that's been made by Hollywood. And so we get used to fairy tales. Sorry, kids. Evolution, you're going to find out, is more of a fairy tale than creation can ever be. Finally, the universe is not eternal, same statement, but it was created by something or someone outside and superior to itself. That's the creation model. So, on the first one, is the universe eternal? There's no doubt that the eternal universe is the most comfortable position for evolutionists because it requires no explanation, you know, whatsoever. It always has been, always will be, keeps going. In fact, to avoid this problem, Dr. Fred Hoyle suggested that the best way to try and explain an expanding and eternal universe was suggest that at points in space called eutrons, hydrogen was coming into existence out of nothing. That there are little points, you know, where the universe is constantly renewing itself. However, in the book, Until the Sun Dies, astronomer Robert Jastrow wrote that the proposal for the creation of matter out of nothing possesses a strong appeal to the scientist since it permits him to contemplate a universe without beginning or end. So he doesn't have to worry about coming up with any proof for it. However, same guy said, who was not a creationist, went on to say, but these attempts have not succeeded. And most astronomers have come to the conclusion that they live in an exploding world. Big Bang Theory, you know, had an egg that started. You know, with it. In his book, God and the Astronomers, he explains why. Three lines of evidence: the motion of the galaxies, the laws of thermodynamics, and the life story of the stars, pointing to one conclusion, all indicated that the universe had a beginning And then adds, modern science denies an eternal existence to the universe, either in the past or the future. So scientists are saying it can't have an eternal aspect to it. You know, it looks to a beginning, it looks to an end. Well, what about the creation out of nothing? Well, first of all, of course, it must be stressed that according to the first law of thermodynamics, matter is incapable of creating itself. That's a scientific law. That's what the scientists came up with. Matter cannot create itself. So where does that leave evolution? Scientists are saying this. You know, physicist George Davis declared, no material thing can create itself. Dr. Davis added that this statement cannot be logically attacked on the basis of any knowledge available to us. That is, of all the laws we know about science, not one of them even starts to suggest that matter can create itself. Not scientifically, as far as we know, possible. However, Anthony Kinney, a British evolutionist, suggests in his book, Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas, that something actually came from nothing. In a 1984 issue of Scientific American, an article on the inflationary universe stated, from a historical point of view, probably the most revolutionary aspect of the inflationary model is the notion that all the matter and energy in the observable universe may have emerged from absolutely nothing, or from almost nothing. Not a definite statement there. He gives himself a little hedge. Almost nothing. Such a concept, however, has met with serious opposition from within the scientific establishment. A lot of scientists do not agree with that statement. Ralph F. Esling wrote a stinging rebuke in the 1994 edition of the Skeptical Inquirer. And so they conjure us an entire cosmos, or even myriads of cosmoses, suddenly, inexplicably, causelessly, leaping into being out of nothing. Whatsoever, for no reason at all. That's just part of the statement. This universe possessed the interesting attributes of infinite temperature, infinite density, infinitesimal volume, a rather gripping state of affairs, as well as something of a sudden and dramatic change from nothing whatsoever. Okay, let's get a little contained area. In here is nothing. Absolutely nothing. No being, no matter, no causing of things, no material, just absolutely nothing. But something made it create something. Okay. How smart do you think these guys are? The renowned British astrophysicist Stephen Hawking wrote, in my personal opinion, the new inflationary model is now dead as a scientific theory. Okay. Scientists saying this can't happen. In his book, Not a Chance, R.C. Sproul wrote, for something to bring itself into being, it must have the power of being within itself. Yeah, it's got to be there first. It must at least have enough causal power to cause its own being. So it's got to cause itself to exist before it exists. It would have to have the causal power to being before it was. It would have to have the power of being before it had any being with which to exercise that power. Thus, there is not a chance the universe could have created itself. I mean, where is nothing going to give any kind of mind in order to will something to occur or to cause something to happen? I mean, if there was something, how did it get there? Now you have to explain how that being got there. But the result of creation, if the universe had a beginning, It either had a cause or it did not have a cause. One thing we know, it is correct, both scientifically and philosophically, to acknowledge that the universe had an adequate antecedent cause. The cause-effect principle states that whatever there is a material, I'm stressing that, material effect, there must be an adequate antecedent cause. So as we're talking about this theory, we're talking about things that are material. We're not talking about things that are spiritual. And that the cause has to be adequate. Explains, yeah. If you ever have a ball, even a super ball, and you drop it, it hits the ground but doesn't ever quite come back up to the dropping point unless you put a little something else into it. So whatever caused the effect has to have greater power or potential than the effect itself. So as we look at the effect of the universe, I mean, if you can imagine all the power in the stars, the novas, the galaxies, all the galaxies put together, the black holes, okay, all that superpower out there, it has to be greater in God than it is in the universe. Has to be by scientific principle. If you take all the smarts that man has, all the intelligence, and you put it all together, the intelligence of God had to be greater in order to create it. Further indicated, however, is the fact that no effect can be qualitatively superior or qualitatively greater than the cause. That's what we just explained. It is apparent then that the universe was created by something or someone. Okay, choices. That existed before, that is, some eternal, uncaused first cause. It had to be superior to the creation. The created cannot be superior to the creator. And it has to be of a different nature since the finite, dependent universe of matter is unable to explain itself. From what we see within the cosmos, within the nature of the universe, there's nothing there in all its laws that will explain how it came to be. So it has to be something totally different than the material that caused it all. It has to be the mind of something, the spiritual aspect of something. If there had been a time when absolutely nothing existed, then there would still be nothing now. It would go on as always. Nothing produces nothing. Okay? Now, we got verification of that in the realm of science and in the scripture. In the scripture, God has told us like produces like. Scientists in cell theory says, well, cell you have, it reproduces just like itself. Doesn't morph into something else. Can't produce something that's not like itself. And, you know, what's interesting about this then, if there was nothing, all nothing would produce would be nothing. Since something does exist, it must follow logic. You're probably totally confused by now, you know, but well, we're almost done. Since something does exist, it must follow logically that something has existed forever. Everything that exists can be classified as either matter or mind. There is no third alternative. Therefore, neither matter or mind is eternal, since it is scientifically proven that matter is not eternal, then it is the mind that is eternal. And that's something we know. The spirit within us goes on forever. That which is the psyche. In the past, atheistic evolutionists suggested that the mind was nothing more than the function of the brain. I mean, they're still caught up on man is just, you know, if you assemble all the atoms and the molecules right, you get a living person. This is wrong on so many levels. I almost want to go back to the story of Frankenstein. Did Frankenstein create life? Well, first of all, he's collecting dead bodies to sew them together. You know, that's something he didn't make. He supposedly harnessed the power of electricity to zip through this creation to bring it to life. Where did he get the electricity from? If you look at the movie, it's from God, you know, the heavens. And he even had to send away for all the apparatus, you know, to put together to generate all this stuff. What did he create? But the concept is still there that all you need is the proper arrangement of molecules. You can see this in Star Trek, you know, with the transporter beam. You know, take everything apart, flip it someplace else, and assemble it all together, and it's going to live in your wildest dreams. You know, that's science fiction and unprovable. However, there's no longer credible scientifically, due in large part to the experiments of Australian physiologist Sir John Eccles. Now, you might want to get this guy's book and read the experiments. Dr. Eccles, who won the Nobel Prize for his discoveries relating to the neural synapses within the brain. A synapse is the little gap in the nervous system. Your nerves aren't one long string. It's little segments, and there's chemicals in the joining of it where electrical impulses have to jump through the chemistry through the next nerve, you know, ending. The dendrites, you know, help with this. What he found out, you know, what's going on in the brain. I mean, how does the mind, you know, if it's just nothing but an accumulation of molecules, how does it function? What makes it want to think about something? He showed that the supplementary motor area of the brain can be fired by mere intention. That is, as you're looking at the brain that's sitting there, nothing has to operate. Nothing has to move. Except there be an intention by the will of man to fire it up. No chemical reaction, no mechanical process. There was something there that was operating that he could show that was beyond just this complex of molecules and atoms assembled in a proper arrangement. A cause can communicate to its effect only what it has to communicate. If our mind or ability to know is received, then there must be a mind, God, that gave it. Okay. How do you get ability to think from something that can't think? I mean, this is the big question for a lot of whatever model you're looking at, even in ourselves. We have a tendency, you know, we have an ability to go out and look at a sunrise and go, ooh, ah, you know, pretty. Aesthetic qualities, colors and flowers, the aroma of certain things. It's all appreciated. You know, we look at art and know what's good and what's bad, or what we like and what we don't like. Where does that come from? Unless it's given to us, because it sure can develop on its own. Or the ability to think. We're going to look at Darwin's problem with that. You can't just have something, all these things that are in man that you don't find anywhere else. It has to be given and designed into man. It's too complex and too above anything else in the universe. Oh, that's it. Anyway, that's something to think about. And we'll get into more of this. And again, it's we're going to be showing you what scientists, many scientists think. You know, that they're left with the conclusion that there is a God. You know, it's not ad hoc that, well, I'm a scientist, therefore I don't believe in God. If you do not believe in God, you did not get there by a scientific method. And what we're going to be doing is offering the evidence and the facts that you can assemble together and come out with a proper conclusion, you know, which model you want to accept. And I believe we can confidently say as Christians, even though we're not dealing with the scriptures, and the scriptures are just as powerful, if not more so, of God stating, you know, God really doesn't, in many cases, prove his existence as he starts out in the scriptures. Yeah, he just started talking to God, and man was listening. Or God started talking to man, and man was listening. They didn't have, you know, much of a choice, you know, no more than Pharaoh did. They knew he existed. I mean, he was evident before them. The patriarchs, he talked to the heads of the family with Moses. He approved his, you know, his laws by the miracles he did. You know, there wasn't any of this, well, does God exist or not? Just about everybody believed in God or a variation of it. They worshipped other gods. But you hardly find a civilization that hasn't got some capacity or some drive to worship something. And that's God's prodding inside of us. What Paul told the Athenians, those great, you know, thinkers, you know, of the past, he says, you know, what did God do? He made of all, you know, one blood. You can verify that. I mean, our blood is not interchangeable with apes or sharks or anything else. Yeah, you guys, you know, younger ones weren't around through that. Well, the big debates, you know, where did man come from? You know, he had his origin in the monkeys, or there was a time when they thought, well, the monkey isn't working out, so maybe a shark. We're closer to that. You know, big debates on that, and that all went by the wayside because our blood is not interchangeable with them. But our blood is interchangeable with other humans. And he says that God drew the boundaries of all nations with a purpose. He's not very far from any of us in hopes that we might seek him. Okay, and we get rid of all the mess that people try to distract you with. You'll find God all around you. You know, in that aesthetic draw, in the quality of the sunsets, in the smell and beauty of the flowers, you know, in the way things are working, the seasons as they come in, you know, like a cyclic event. God taking care of his creation and working it. There's evidence of him all around us. This is what, you know, inspired a lot of the early scientists. You know, they were impressed, you know, with the workings of God. And they made it their career to find out, you know, the things that God was doing and working and giving man, blessing man with. And this is what we're trying to present to you in these lessons. But not only from, you know, the scriptures. I said there's a lot of things that in the scriptures you can find, whether it's prophecy or eyewitnesses to miracles or the type, anti-type. I mean, what you find in the scripture, you won't find anywhere in any man-made book. They just couldn't do it. Because what man has written, you know, a library of books over 1,500 years from various cultures and walks of life and everything else, and all say the same thing. Praise the one God and show his workings. You know, it has to be from God. Okay. But what we're going to show is also scientists are showing from the natural world that God does exist. And only he could have brought us where we are. Okay. And if you want to be a part of that, really, it does give purpose. You know, it does tell us, you know, exactly, you know, where we came from, that we are the offspring of God, that we are, you know, unfortunately, even though we were made in his image, we've lost that. You know? What the scriptures tell us, though, is where we're going, how we can correct the damage we've done to ourselves and sin, you know, how we can prepare ourselves for judgment day and to be able to meet God with confidence in a world beyond this one. The scriptures give us an insight into that. Worlds beyond worlds. And this is something that is a priority in our lives, or should be. More important than anything. Too often we put things off, you know, I got to study for an exam, you know, at school, or I got to finish this stuff at work, whatever. When you get to Judgment Day and the hereafter, you'll realize just how much it wasn't that important. What was important was, how close are you to your God? What do you know about Him? And how obedient have you been? If there's anything we can do to help you make sure that you're right with your Creator, please let us know as we stand to sing.